Morning, New Covenant. This is Kevin. I'm glad to be back with you for my monthly time in the teaching rotation here. And like we've been doing for a little bit, I went to the lectionary this week to see what themes were there that rhymed with things I was going through and what I imagine you all are going through, and hope that what I found there is guided by the Spirit and speaks to you where you are. So may the Lord be with me, and may the Spirit be with us as you spend time with the scriptures and with my meditations on it. I want to take most of my teaching today from the passage from the book of Judges that's in today's lectionary. We didn't read that in the service today, and I won't read it here, but I'll refer it to you. I'm going to just be drawing from the broader story of Judges chapter 4 and 5, of which we just get a few verses in today's lectionary. But if you don't know this story, it's a little obscure. I think you'll get a good sense of it today. Judges chapter 4 and 5 is the story of Deborah, the prophet and judge of Israel. And it's a story of women who see injustice and act on it. It's also a story of men who rightly recognize that and fall in line behind these women, among other things. The stories here come at a strange time for Israel, when the Hebrews probably swung between deep and painful questions about how long they would wait for realization of God's promises and forgetting those promises altogether. Just as today, when we often are wondering where we really are in God's story, the Hebrews during the time of the stories recounted in the book of Judges must have spent many days in doubt, worry, confusion, or just surrender, giving up. So why is this one little brief chapter in the book of Judges one of the scarce few in the scriptures when we see women in political leadership? It's a story that I'll recount more here in a bit, but it's a story, again, of a judge named Deborah, a leader named Deborah, and it is a rare one in the Bible. Even the details of this story are scarce, and maybe for good reason, given how many more men have played a role in editing the scriptures than women. So I'm going to take some inspiration here in my relationship to this passage, these brief verses about this woman and other women around her. I'm going to take some inspiration from the Reverend Will Gaffney, a Black feminist scholar and Episcopal priest. And I'm going to do some speculation today that I pray provokes you to thought and action in your own path with Jesus. Reverend Gaffney's work has been an influence on me for some time, both for how she teaches exactly to these gaps in Scripture, the smallest little stories, the questions of why we don't see more women in the Bible. And her work has also influenced me for how, in the face of that, she believes that the vision of interpretation and community with the Holy Spirit that we see towards the scriptures and church traditions calls on teachers to reach and imagine, to translate these sparser stories of the Bible with greater imagination and strength into our moment. So, Deborah, the leader of Israel that's introduced in this chapter 4 of Judges, who was she? She was the fifth leader of Israel after Moses, according to the stories. She comes on the scene after everyone who'd escaped Egypt and wandered in the desert for all those years had died, probably well over a century into Israel's life in Canaan. Compared to the clear leadership structure Israel enjoyed in the desert, organized by tribes under the family of Moses, the role of Deborah and the judges who preceded and follow her is not really very clear. The tribes are, at this point, dispersed all throughout Canaan. They're not even living in one place, and they're living in wildly different situations socially. Each of the 12 tribes lays claim to a different part of the land, sometimes driving the inhabitants of Canaan out, other times just living among them. And unsurprisingly, this dispersal, this disaggregation of a people that was quite unified in their exile in the desert, leads to two things. First, family by family, tribe by tribe, the people lose their way and forget what God rescued them to do. They forget their inheritance, as promised to Abraham and Sarah's descendants. They take on all the ways and habits of their neighbors. And second, this dispersed life in Canaan early on in Israel's life there, they find that the inhabitants of Canaan don't really like being displaced, again, unsurprisingly. And the Canaanites come back hard against the Hebrews, in whole or in part, one tribe at a time, or taking on all of them. There's just battle after battle, skirmish after skirmish. So the generation or two following Moses, as the people have really finally arrived at the land of milk and honey, appears very disorganized, dispersed. It's confusing. It's cloudy. It befits a story of exile, befits a story of forced migration. The leadership transition after Moses and his successor Joshua die is kind of strange. This doesn't seem very clear in the book. Leaders only seem to rise up when there's a need for liberation within the seemingly endless skirmishes with Canaanites. Joshua's successor, Othniel, comes from one of the Hebrew tribes, as does his successor, Ehud, and both seem mild successes in at least fighting back some of the oppressors and helping at least some parts and tribes of Israel remember for a little while their future, their place in history. But then after those two, another leader comes on named Shamgar. He comes and goes with just one significant military success, but a vision of Israel unsafe and defeated. Under Shamgar's rule there, we read, quote, the highways were abandoned, travelers took to winding paths. And despite oppression from neighbors, under Shamgar, quote, villagers in Israel would not fight. It's a strange picture, a desolate picture. Again, of this dispersed Israel, an in-between time, neither fully realizing their promise, and maybe even forgetting their promise, nor unified in a wandering desert. This picture of rule under Shamgar, the third ruler after Joshua, seems one of lack of identity, of vulnerability, of fear. And Jewish scholars don't even believe that Shamgar came from one of the tribes, that he may have simply been an opportunistic Canaanite seeing a chance to jump into the endless war of allegiances. And then, after these judges, these strange judges that come and go without a lot of purpose, comes Deborah, the fifth. We don't know much about where she comes from either. We don't know her bloodline. But we know that she manages to unite Israel as they hadn't been since their time in the desert, and that her leadership leads to 40 years of peace. She builds a coalition. People see her uniquely as leading with God's power, not just responding opportunistically to what's going on. And even those on the margins of Israel join her quest. We don't know much. We don't know how much her leadership advances Israel to any destined role or point of completion, really. The story's kind of isolated, and even that's kind of a provocation to maybe our understanding of what leaders do. Hers is leadership that doesn't really wait for history. It doesn't act with the point of history in mind. It's not like Joshua's example, where he really saw himself as a kind of clearer of land, almost a Columbus-like figure making way for his people to live. It's not like any of the others we see. We don't really know what ball gets moved in the longer game here. Deborah simply acts from a place of principle and conviction. She seems to work utterly within the present. So Deborah's rise comes at a time in the story that's described in two differing ways. In Judges chapter 4, we learn that at this point, Israel had fallen under the power of a Canaanite king named Jabin, whose ruthless military commander named Sisera kept order through 900 iron chariots and a reputation for sexual violence. The commander, military commander Sisera's reputation for this mode of control through violence against women, was so known and so accepted as a means of control that we read in the book that even Sisera's mother casually reports that if he's late coming back from a battle, no need to worry. He was probably just plundering and doing what he wished with the women among those he conquered. It's a horrible thing. In Judges chapter 5, we get a slightly different picture of Israel's state at this time, the time of the rise of Deborah. In Judges 5, I should mention, is attributed to Deborah herself because it's in form of a song that we're told she sings. And we learn there that though that all of Israel does not experience this oppression under Jabin and Sisera equally, or at least that they don't all feel the same call to respond. Some of the tribe of Ephraim showed up to respond to this oppression. The families of Benjamin, Naphtali, and Zebulun, all descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, also showed up, as well as the tribe of Issachar. They all start to notice and respond to what's going on here in this reign of terror. But the families of Reuben, Gilead, Dan, Asher, they didn't. Deborah sings about these tribes as taken up with their own matters. Reuben with their sheep, Dan with their ships, Asher with their coastal property. So even though Deborah's able to call together an unprecedented coalition to rise up against this oppressive regime, there are others who, even in the face of a corrupt and powerful Sisera, would rather play it safe. Knowing Sisera's reputation, this is really, truly horrible. These other families must have made deals of various kinds, arrangements that made them okay with Sisera's reign of terror through military might and violence against women. Deborah's ability to build a coalition is significant, but a more powerful witness to her strength is that her military right hand, a man named Barak, refused to go to war in defense of Israel as she commanded unless she joined him. She gave him 10,000 men. Even then, he wouldn't go. Wasn't enough. He told her he would only go with those 10,000 men against Sisera, if she as well joined them. Only her presence as a strategist, fighter, and judge would give him confidence. And because she agreed to those conditions, Barak did go to battle and won. I believe that at least part of this, when we read the scriptures, comes from Barak seeing Deborah as clearly following the Lord. And significantly, it wasn't even Barak or Deborah that finally put evil Sisera to death. Deborah was looking out with principle. Barak recognized her as following the Lord. A coalition built around them, and others joined in as well. In the case of Sisera, the military commander, it was actually a woman not even part of the battle that put him to death. Her name was Jael. Jael and her husband Heber were most likely not descendants of Abraham, but of others who escaped Egypt with the Hebrews and joined Israel in the spirit of hospitality toward the other that we see throughout the gospel and throughout the law. At the time of Deborah's rise against Jabin and Sisera, however, Jael and Heber's family were on the other side of the conflict. They were allied with King Jabin and his military commander, Sisera. So Sisera escaped the battle with Deborah and Barak after they eliminated all of Sisera's army. And the evil Sisera fled to Heber and Jael's camp, where Jael welcomed him into a tent to rest and eat. What deal had the man Heber made with evil Sisera at this point? I wonder what violence Jael had witnessed by Sisera, perhaps even on her own body, her own family, through the past conquests and reign, that somehow made Heber an ally. We don't know. But what we do know is that Jael waited till Sisera was asleep. And then, as Deborah sings, she drove a tent peg through the side of Sisera's head until it went into the ground. In her song about the event, Deborah sings that he fell, quote, at Jael's feet. And in some translations, Deborah sings about Sisera dying between Jael's feet. The implications are clear here. This is a woman who descended from aliens to both Israel and Canaan, and who was quite likely on the receiving end of a violent regime of control. And it was she who ended that regime by her own hand. What an interesting trajectory here. Deborah sees oppression and acts. Barak recognizes her strength and follows her. A coalition grows around her, and a regime comes to an end. And so Israel's tribes enjoyed a new season of peace, at least for a while. Driven not by conquest of new land, they didn't expand their territory. There's no great bloodline continued here. This is a season of peace that comes through the work of a leader who, unlike the men around her, saw enough to act to end a repressive regime taking place right before her and against her. It's notable that she comes from no clear bloodline. Her very residence, actually, is not even in any of the towns associated with the tribes of Israel. We learn from the Book of Judges that she lives at a kind of crossroads between a few such towns. She's a quintessentially person in between in Israel in a time when it itself as a nation is in between. And people followed her, like Barak followed her, not because of where she stood, who she came from, or even what history they saw her advancing, but because it was evident who she was acting with and on whose behalf. Actually, before this conflict, we learn that many Israelites came to her for help in deciding their disputes. It's an almost Solomonic picture. Her principles there, and her having had enough of a land ruled by a reign of terror against women, were what made Barak and others see her as fighting with the strength of the Lord. There are plenty of places in the scriptures where we see God working through the underdog, the least expected actor. We celebrate this all the time at New Covenant. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The last becomes the first. The youngest becomes the king. And in this pattern, we see that God works solely through God's power, not through ours. But this story of Deborah and even of Jael is a little different. In this story, we see that it is not only in a person with less standing, a woman in a patriarchal society and without a blood right to leadership, that we see God most able to work. That's familiar. But that here, God's truth is more visible and actionable to a person in that role. I'll say that again. The significance of Deborah's position here is not only that she's in the margins, that she's in a position of not having as much power, so that God's power can be more evident, but that in her position, she can see more clearly God's truth. A woman under that regime of evil Sisera could see what needed doing more clearly than a man. In that clarity of vision, combined with her wisdom as a judge and skill as a military tactician, was what hailed others and gathered them to her strength. Reading this story of Deborah, the judge and prophet, in the context of today's other lectionary readings, I take one further lesson. Many of our scriptures today dwell on how God's timeline and sense of history is different from ours. From Psalm 90, that we'll sing a bit from shortly, verses 4 and 5, "For 1,000 years in your sight, Lord, are like yesterday when it is past, or like a watch in the night. You sweep them away. They're like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning." Verse 10 from Psalm 90, "The days of our life are 70 years, or maybe 80 if we're strong. Even then, their span is only toil and trouble. They're gone and we fly away." There's this theme there of how time passes quickly for us or sometimes slowly for us, but that the time can't even measure to God's sense of time. And in 1 Thessalonians that we heard read today, chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, the letter writer pens, "Now concerning the times and the seasons, brothers and sisters, you do not need to have anything written to you. For you yourselves know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night." There's a kind of call to not looking at what moment we are in history there. That it could come any time. We're not in a story that's necessarily even unfolding. We're always in the now. Thinking about this in light of where we are right now in this moment in November of 2020, boy, do we want this pandemic to be over. And wow, we really want to see the guilty and those responsible for our nation's crimes fall. We want to see the weak brought up. We want to see an end to the stories of suffering out there. Just as much as the disciples wanted a revolution against the Roman Empire during the time of Jesus, or as much as those disciples wanted their teacher to return after watching him ascend to the skies. But what today's scriptures remind us of is that we do not work toward a destination like that. We work from a position. We don't work to a place. We work from a place. We work from a position. We work from a practice. We work from a principle. We do not work towards an end that we believe we are advancing. To remain vigilant, as Paul urges us to be, is to be ready to act whether or not we think now is the time to leap, or whether we think our actions will count. We are always to be ready to act, because every moment could be when we are called on to act on God's principles and see more of God's truth manifest in the world. The story of Deborah teaches us that some of God's children are just in a better position to see this truth. For white folks like me, the turn to better listening to black folks in my life is not only to correct generations of ignoring them, exploiting them, silencing these voices. It's because these voices from these folks in their positions are better prepared than I to see and act on God's truth. In thinking of today's story, the same is true of women compared to men. Now, this obviously calls for more attention to and support for the voices of the marginalized, as where we are more likely to hear the Lord. But in light of the story of Deborah, and even of Jael, the assassin of Sisera, there's something more here. These women saw clearly, not only from the margins, but from the depths of pain and suffering. They sat with that, lived with that, for longer than I can imagine. And likely with that anger and fear at the oppressive regime around them, shortening their very lives, eating away at their health. To wait patiently with that anger, as Jael did, and act on only when time is a marvel. And to do so, as Deborah did, without a promise of their future role in a story of success, is a tribute to the clarity of their motivations and heart. We don't even know if Deborah saw herself as part of the inheritance here. We don't know what bloodline she came from. We simply know that she saw a world out of alignment with how God designed it to be, and that she needed to act on it. I take her example here as not only a prompt to listen better to those who are suffering, but to consider and come alongside even their anger, a righteous anger that waits like God's own wrath. I'm often afraid of anger myself. I put it away. But today's story challenges me in that. Anger can certainly consume and drive us towards death when it drives the kind of reach for control that Renee talked about last week. But in Deborah, and even in Jael, that anger provided clarity because they waited for the Lord's voice, for the opportunity to be part of God's story. They didn't turn their anger into the story. They waited with it to be part of God's story. The psalmist writes again in today's Psalm 90, verse 11, "Who considers, Lord, the power of your anger? Your wrath is as great as the fear that is due you. So teach us to count our days that we may gain a wise heart." What a move there by the psalmist to consider God's own anger and its magnitude, all the reasons why God looks out upon the world we've abused, the people we've hurt, exploited, killed, the creation we have put under our own feet and neglected as stewards. To consider God's own anger at this, anger towards our violence towards the weakest and most vulnerable. And then to follow that into simply counting our own days, being present in each day, being patient and alert to the call to act on that very righteous anger. That's a new thought for me as someone who's afraid of anger. And I welcome discussion about this. It may not be where you are, and you may have other things to offer this in terms of what righteous anger might be. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that later. But for now, let's move toward communion, where mostly we think about the fact that though we are ourselves are deserving of God's anger, God acted with such love and set that aside to bring us ever closer to God's own self and God's own love. So let's go to communion, meditating on how we do not deserve that mercy, and we come into God's blessing in celebration of the sacrifice that brought us into that presence.